Hello and welcome to today's edition of In Our Welling Time. The big question is, what caused the First World War? With me in the studio today, I have Mr. Heumann.
Hello.
And Mr. McLeod.
Hello.
The First World War was one of the most catastrophic events in human history, killing over 16 million people. Yet, it was not inevitable. This episode explores the long-term causes and short-term triggers that combined to plunge Europe into war, from the web of alliances built up over decades to the race for colonial territory, the mounting arms build-up, simmering nationalist tensions in the Balkans, and the chain of decisions made in the six fateful weeks following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Our first key question is, did the alliance system and global diplomacy make war more or less likely? Mr. Heumann, could you just take us into the Bismarckian system, so Bismarck's approach to diplomacy, and why is that so effective? It seems to be a crucial sort of foundation that he set.
Yes, so a lot of the roots of his Bismarckian system, it comes from the historic tensions between Germany and France, which dates back, you know, most recently, I suppose, to the 1870-71 war, the Franco-Prussian War. And Bismarck, as Chancellor of Germany, embarks on a very difficult mission to try and to seek to avoid a war on two fronts, those two fronts being against the French and the Russians. He's got a careful balancing act because he, at the same time, wants to promote and boost Germany's standing in the world to compete with countries like France and Britain, who, as we know, have big empires and in the case of Britain, a strong navy. And one thing that he keeps in mind is that he has to keep France isolated. And so the Bismarckian system starts off with, around 1873, with something called the Three Emperors League. And this is an alliance, one of the first alliances we look at when we do this topic, between Germany, Austria-Hungary and Russia. And you might find it strange to hear Russia's name there, because Russia eventually ends up on an alliance which is opposing Germany and Austria-Hungary. When Bismarck is dismissed in 1890, this is a bit of a turning point, because in comes, or a few years before that, in 1888, Kaiser Wilhelm II is on the throne, and he marks a bit of a turning point in German history because he removes Bismarck. So Bismarck is dismissed, and this is really significant because it's centres around something called the Reinsurance Treaty, which is allowed to lapse. Now, I need to tell you a little bit about the Reinsurance Treaty. This is a treaty in 1887. It's a secret deal between Germany and Russia where they agree neutrality, that if unless one attacks the other's ally, they will remain neutral. And that was quite reassuring for the Russians. With the arrival of the Kaiser and the lapsing of the Reinsurance Treaty, we've got a situation now where it forces Russia to seek other allies and pushes them more towards the French.
Cool. Okay. Mr. Heumann, thanks so much. We seem like we're getting to a really significant moment, a change in policy with the German state. Can you tell us a little bit about Weltpolitik? So what is Weltpolitik? When does it come in? And why is that so significant? What does that actually do in the international sort of diplomatic world?
Yeah, so Weltpolitik is a policy which is most aligned with the new Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm II, and 1897 is the date, its starting point, which marks a shift in German foreign policy to one which is away from Bismarck's more diplomatic style to a more aggressive expansionist foreign policy where Germany is going to embark on trying to find new colonies, expand its navy, and improve its prestige globally as well.
I'm with you there, and that's really clear. So this seems like a major shift. This must have triggered a reaction amongst neighbouring states. What is the reaction to this?
Yeah, Britain and France were hugely alarmed by this new foreign policy that Germany was embarking on. And what happened then is, and this links back to other alliances, is they formed something called the Franco-Russian Alliance. Russia's also very worried about this, as well as the Brits and the French. And the Franco-Russian Alliance of 1894 was the first alliance between what will become the Triple Alliance. Then you get something called the Entente Cordiale in 1904. And the Entente Cordiale was between Britain and France, which they put their colonial disputes aside, and not necessarily a military alliance at this point, but a diplomatic understanding that they're on the same page, that Germany's the threat.
Absolutely. And then where do we go from that position then? So Entente Cordiale, the beginning of that, the fabric of something really significant between Britain and France in 1904. What happens after that point? Is this developed further by sort of Britain and France, or is it just sort of there and stays there?
Yeah, the Brits and the Russians move closer together in something called the Anglo-Russian Entente of 1907, where they settle previous disputes that they've had over areas such as Persia and then Afghanistan and Tibet. And where it ends up is where we know is the Triple Entente, where Britain, Russia and France form one of the two key armed camps that will be so important when 1914 comes around.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much. And I know we're going to discover a little more through our podcast on what's happening there with Morocco and Northern Africa and the Entente later. But for now, can we just zone in on something that is an interesting point within the the story here, which is the Anglo-Japanese alliance. This is something we could perhaps easily brush past. However, I'm just keen to establish why it matters, particularly in terms of Russia.
Yeah, it may seem like a strange thing to bring up why Britain and joining with Japan in 1902, what that's got to do with the First World War. But I think it's important for two reasons. One, it ends Britain's splendid isolation, which is Britain had been sort of backing away for quite a while from alliances in Europe, and it marks the first major alliance that it's had in decades. That's one thing. It's also significant, it's the first military alliance between a Western and non-Western nation, so there's a sort of global shift there. But in terms of perhaps the most important thing for 1914 is that is the impact that it has on Russia, because it indirectly leads, this Anglo-Japanese alliance of 1902, it indirectly leads to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5, because it's with Japan feeling emboldened by having the support of Britain and Russia feeling exposed, it leads to this conflict, which happens between Russia and Japan in 1904-5, and a humiliating defeat for the Russians there. And linking it back to 1914, why it's significant is because Russia's now going to focus its attention not on Asia after this bruising defeat, but actually sort of play its cards in Europe more and to try and strengthen its ties in the Balkans area. And that will come into play when we look at the Balkans crisis and the 1914 crisis, where Russia lends its support towards Serbia. But more of that later.
Can I just jump in on that point
Please
as well? Because the other aspect of that Russian humiliation is that it is one of a couple of humiliations that Russia then faces, which leads us to explain why Russia would then jump in and jump into the war with Austria in the June crisis of 1914. So Russia has two significant humiliations in that run-up to the 1914 moment.
Mm. Mr. McLeod, thank you so much. And I know that we're going to pick up on Russia's humiliation, significant humiliation, in terms of the Bosnian crisis of 1908 later on in the podcast. So for now, I think we can move forward to our second fundamental question for today, which is how far did colonial problems create tensions between the great powers? So here we have imperialism to think about here, and we've already heard about the the power of various nations. But Britain controls a quarter of the world's land surface. France has got substantial territory in Africa and Asia. And now we have Germany, who has just unified as a very young nation in 1871. And the Kaiser has now got a new course, or as von Bülow said, the Chancellor in 1897, an opportunity for Germany to take its place in the sun. Not that it wanted to put other nations in the shade. So let's get into the detail now. And the first key question, I think, for us to think about is a bit of grounding. What was the scramble for Africa, and how does that create rivalry between the key kind of European empires?
To sort of move on from what Mr. Huyn has been saying about German Weltpolitik, this is growing in the sort of late 19th century and is rubbing up against the existing empires of expressly France and Britain. Britain had by far the largest empire in the world at the time, but France was also significant in imperial possessions. As we've already mentioned, Britain is abandoning splendid isolation and going into these treaties in order to deal with the rise of this upstart German power being driven after 1888 by both Wilhelm II and his new chancellor, Caprivi. Both of these leaders really drove forward with naval expansion in order to extend German authority. But one of the key diplomatic efforts actually comes on the back of something which Bismarck had started, the Congress of Berlin of 1884-1885, which had been the first attempt by Germany to sort of put themselves onto the global stage more as a sort of a policeman, or as certainly somebody who would have something to say on imperial matters. But the focus for Germany had been to look at Africa, in particular North Africa, to try to ensure that it has a place in the world.
Okay, so it's clearly establishing itself, or looking to do so, as so far as it could do. But this sounds pretty peaceful. It sounds like empires coming together. carving up Africa is one thing, but like a significant conflict in terms of Europe, that seems very distant and far off. So how on earth do we get from this sort of colonial rivalry and then agreements at the Congress of Berlin and after that point to significant conflict or an escalation in terms of the level of threat or potential conflict within sort of Europe? Perhaps the best linking point here is to think then about what actually happened in what we call the first Moroccan crisis, 1905-6. So what happened there, and what were the consequences of it?
So I think the first thing to say as well is that I don't think Germany and the Kaiser didn't think they were doing anything which was too outrageous. They wanted their own place in the sun, and they were taken aback by the fact that suddenly these imperial powers were ranged against them in this new Entente Cordiale. And so what their colonial efforts somewhat changed from expansion to trying to split the Entente Cordiale, and this then led to direct conflict between themselves and French colonial possessions. And that is very obvious in the first Moroccan crisis of 1905-1906, when Kaiser Wilhelm actually went to Tangier in Morocco, declared the support for Moroccan independence from France, which then posited Germany against France in Morocco, and then fell back on their diplomatic status to demand that there be an international conference to work out what should happen in Morocco. This was due to happen in 1906.
So surely at this point, I mean, that's very exciting. It is, again, it's ambitious. You could say critically, potentially here, rather aggressive in terms of its manoeuvring. But as you've highlighted there, Germany are feeling vulnerable. and they feel like they have to act at this moment in time. So it looks to my mind then that the Kaiser here has set things up brilliantly, at least potentially. So what then happens in terms of that conference? Does it work out for the Kaiser and Germany or not?
Well, absolutely not. And I think this speaks to the fact that, again, there is a lack of understanding from within the German government as to how their manoeuvres are being perceived by Britain and France. They are seeing themselves as, you know, of equality with Britain and France, and Britain and France are actually much more aligned in making sure Germany does not join their particular party. And so, rather to their surprise, Britain backs France at this international conference at Algeciras. And actually, Germany is left diplomatically isolated from Britain and France. And actually, rather than split the Entente Cordiale, the irony is they actually strengthen the Entente, leaving Kaiser with a bit of egg on his face.
And this is where the alliance system comes back in again, doesn't it? It's Britain and France working together, and Germany sort of losing out on this occasion.
Okay, so in this mix so far, we've got the alliance system there. We've got Germany humiliated. The opposite has happened in terms of what the Kaiser Wilhelm was looking for. The Entente is in fact strengthened, not broken, in terms of Algeciras and 1906. There's a bit of distance, there's a bit of time between Algeciras and 1906 and then what we might refer to as the second Moroccan crisis or the Agadir crisis of 1911. Germany is sending a gunboat called the Panther to Agadir. Why are they doing that?
They just couldn't let it go, could they?
What is so important about gunboats in this context? And why are people getting very animated about their power and showing their power in this rather very open way?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to note that this bit of the course of the textbook obviously jumps from Morocco to Agadir, but in between those two things, some big things have changed. And one of the biggest things is the naval arms race has massively heated up. The first Moroccan crisis is all done in 1906. The same year that conference ends, HMS Dreadnought is launched by the British. And this is a brand new type of ship, much faster, much stronger, larger guns, much more heavily armoured than any ship that was around at the time. In the years before, air forces and ballistic missiles, these things were the top tier piece of kit. And what that launched was the naval arms race and the building of as many dreadnought-style ships as could be between Britain and Germany. You've also got, in the years after this, 1907, the Anglo-Russian alliance, and the Entente now includes three powers, not just two. And in the as we are beginning to see Germany increasingly isolated, Germany again tries to flex its colonial muscles and again attempts to drive a wedge between the British and the French. And so the Agadir crisis is a massive moment in this escalation of conflict.
I thought that Germany were acting to sort of protect their own people, and that seems rather reasonable. So how does it develop into such a crisis?
Well, certainly on the surface, that's what it was supposed to be, and of course that's exactly how the Kaiser would like us, or would like the world to have seen it. But when he sends a gunboat out to the port of Agadir, loitering outside French territory, it is exactly the intention is here to intimidate France and to try and ensure that they can get some territorial concessions from France.
Okay, and it's not just the French, is it? Who else is provoked by this?
Well, the big pinch point at the time is the Straits of Gibraltar, which are the access point to the Mediterranean. So hugely strategically important and controlled by the British territory of Gibraltar. So this is also a direct threat to Gibraltar and access into the Mediterranean.
Okay, understood. So Britain's role here does seem to be significant. And in terms of a diplomatic approach, we have a figure coming into the mix here who takes a principal role later on in history, in fact, later on becoming a prime minister. But this is David Lloyd George. So he gives a rather famous speech called the Mansion House speech in 1911. And why did that matter? What did he say? And why was that just so significant?
Well, the Mansion House speech ratchets up the rhetoric around this this colonial issue, because he stands up and he says that Britain is not going to stand by and allow itself to be threatened by Germany, and that Britain would take whatever measures would be necessary to defend its position in the world.
Okay, so it's peace, but it's not at any cost.
Absolutely. And actually, saying that he's not about to be threatened by Germany is also sort of setting the bar relatively low for them actually to have a conflict. And Germany, I think, is taken aback by just the unity between Britain and France. Germany actually is as a result of the Agadir crisis, is not prepared to ratchet up the tension any further than this, and settles for two small strips of the Congo in return for a de-escalation of this particular crisis. Again,
I cannot have gone down very well.
Well, much worse than they'd hoped. Again, they hoped to drive this wedge between France and Britain, and actually to try and test that triple entente to see if Britain would come in. And they didn't think that Britain would come in as hard as it did, and they did. And so, again, they were forced to accept something lesser than what they wanted. And the German public were outraged by this. And there was a sense that actually Germany was being ganged up on by these other powers, because what's this got to do with Britain? Right, their gunboat had been sent to defend German citizens in a French territory, and now the British Prime Minister is standing up and threatening war. So suddenly, this is becoming a much more heated.
Do we think like they had a case, Germany, to feel a bit aggrieved? You know that.
Well, I think there's a case that. At the time, it's not unreasonable for Germany to be going the way that it did. Bismarck has done a great job in defending Germany. It's set up to be a world power. It's recognised that you need overseas territories. It's just doing, it's playing the same rules off the same playbook as Britain and France has been doing for years. Mm. And yet now they are being punished for pursuing the same goals through the same means as Britain and France had done.
I think there's also something really significant about identity and identity politics as well. So I think the conservative elements in German society, so the Junkers, the Kaiser himself and his group, they've certainly politicized the population, and they've managed to mobilize public sentiment behind the imperial project and behind this sort of identity of Germany is the coming power. And so you have that in combination also with this sense of encirclement, this genuine feeling of being trapped and hemmed in by pretty hostile and very powerful states and empires. So this idea of encirclement, I think, is fundamental. It's also fascinating and important to think about how the gearing within German society, if you connect that to politics, the economy is also fundamentally geared towards imperial expansion and potential war as well. By 1913, they are 490 billion marks in debt. And the major reason for that is because they are building a huge amount of very, very good battleships to try to rival Britain.
And on the other side, so I think we've dealt with Germany really well and the impact it has on Germany, but to turn it on to the other side, the impact it has on Britain and France is also really substantial. So whereas you know, the first Moroccan crisis, we have diplomatic unity between Britain and France and that sort of diplomatic closeness. The Agadir crisis forms a secret military alliance and treaty, and the deal that they strike very clearly is that the Royal Navy is going to protect France's northern coast, and that the French Navy is going to be responsible for Mediterranean. So the Agadir crisis also causes a secret agreement which draws up the a military map of Europe. And this is now, again, we're beginning to see it really ratcheting towards a conflict here.
Mm. So this is vital then. So we have an irony. So Germany, with its colonial gambits, each time it's tried to drive that wedge between Britain and France, it draws them, binds them closer together. By 1911, the two powers had secret military and naval agreements, as Mr. MacLeod has just drawn our reference to. German aggression or expansion, perhaps justifiable in a sense, as we've discussed, that's achieved precisely what it feared most. We have a coordinated coalition with substantial armaments against it. And we also have public statements like that from David Lloyd George saying that Britain isn't going to tolerate anything that's going to threaten its status on the global stage. So we're getting something really significant now. So perhaps we can now turn to what we can refer to as the powder keg of the Balkans within the European context. So why were the problems in the Balkans so difficult for the great powers to solve? Let's kick off with, why was the decline of the sick man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire, such a problem?
I can absolutely feel this one. Ottoman Empire, this old creaking empire to the east of Europe, had been losing territory throughout the 19th century. Now, the key area here is this Balkan region. And the Balkan region is still today packed full of different nationalities, different cultures. And as the Ottoman Empire began to collapse, you had these different nationalities, Greek, Serbian, Bulgarian, Bosnian groups beginning to try to develop their own nationalisms. But you've also got the problem that the Russian Empire is looming to the north, having lost in the east against the Japanese in 1904. This is a potential area of expansion for the Russians and to get influence down and to control for them, crucially, the sea lanes out of the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean. But you've also got looming sort of to the north, northwest of the Balkan region, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who likewise, they have the only place that they can begin to look to expand is southwards towards the Balkans. They've got friends to the north and the Germans, and the Italians is not really an option. So we've got an area where you've got nascent or growing nationalisms, and it's also going to be an area competed over by the two great powers of Russia and the Austro-Hungarians.
Sounds like an absolute nightmare. In terms of the Slavs, well, who are the Slavs? Can we be introduced to them? So what people are we talking about here? What territories? And what are they after? I particularly remember just being, taught and then having taught pupils about the importance of Serbia in this context. What's going on with Serbia?
Yeah, so I've talked about this, the nationalisms, and this is the best expression of this is this pan-Slavic movement. This idea that there should be a unity of what we can term the Slavic races. And so we talk about Slavs, we're talking about Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, Czechs, groups within the Balkan regions. The key power here is Serbia. Serbia sees itself as the key pan-Slavic power, and their ambition is to create a greater Serbia that would unite all of these groups of southern Slavs, and that would be taking stuff away from the Austro-Hungarian Empire whilst, you know, carving out their own power in the Balkans. And that is going to be a massive threat to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which within itself is, you know, divided under, you know, with loads of different nationalities. As we know from the 1848 revolutions, you know, they are dealing with, you know, development of nationalism, and all the Austro-Hungarian Empire are terrified of the development of nationalism within its own empire. Yeah. So these Pan-Slavs have got to be crushed from the Austro-Hungarian
Empire. In a sense, quite rightly too. Just, you know, the Austrians themselves and sort of the German speakers within that empire, they are in a clear minority. So it is an interesting and tense scenario. Let's think then about Russia here. So we've talked there about the Slavs, we talked about the Austro-Hungarian scenario. What's Russia doing? What is it thinking? What is its role here? And why is it just so determined to keep its oar in, as it were, to keep its iron in this sort of, again, Balkan fire?
So as I've already mentioned, you know, Russia has this incredible strategic interest in the Balkans, in that the Black Sea and the peninsula of the Crimea is the only warm water port that Russia has in the western bit of Russia. So the access through the straits just next to modern-day Istanbul are really, really important to Russia. It's still today are important for Russia. Now, the Russians see as well themselves as the defenders of this Pan-Slav group and the Slavic nationalism.
Oh, I've heard about this, but why? What are their grounds?
Well,
for that?
There's a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's politically useful because it's a bulwark against the Austrian expansion down south. But there is actually cultural links between them, because actually the Slavs within this region, many of them shared the Russian Orthodox Christian faith, and so there is a genuine cultural link there that you know, isn't just politically useful.
Okay. So this has set the scene then for what we now know as the Bosnian crisis of 1908. What happens here? We've talked about the big powers, Russia, Austria. What happens there in the Bosnian crisis for those two major powers in particular?
So 1908 is a massive year for the Ottoman Empire. So the sick man of Europe, we've just talked about the sick man of Europe, becomes really critically ill in 1908 because there's a massive revolution. The Young Turk Revolution sweeps through Ottoman Turkey, and the Sultan is forced to create a new constitution. This moment of weakness leaves areas in the Balkans exposed, because in particular there are two regions, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and these areas are still technically in 1908 officially under Ottoman rule, although in reality the Austrians had occupied those regions since the 1870s. Now the Austrians, seeing what's going on in the Ottoman Empire, say, well, because of the political turmoil in Turkey, we are now going to take over fully Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1908. And that annexation is obviously a massive threat to this Pan-Slavic movement in Serbia, because now Austria has advanced its empire right to the border of Serbia. And it's going to be a real test of this Serbian-Russian relationship that is beginning to be formed here.
And then in terms of the reality, so we have the annexation. I'm keen now to hear about what does that trigger in terms of reactions, both within the Balkan states themselves, but then also those huge empires. How do they handle this crisis?
So Serbia is, as I already mentioned, massively worried about this. And it turns to Russia and says, right, you promised us your support. What can you do for us? And the answer is not a whole lot. Actually, Russia is fairly weak. They are nervous because actually Austria hasn't just done this on its own. It's got the backing of Germany. And so Russia is not about to risk a wider conflict with both Austria and Germany at this stage.
Fairly bruised, isn't it? From the Russo-Japanese War, it's only a few years after that and not in a great place militarily at this stage. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're pretty clear there. So
you've also got Germany, haven't you? What's Germany's reaction here?
As I said, I mean the support that they give to Austria is a massive disincentive to Russia from intervening.
Yeah, and I suppose there's such a strong contrast, isn't there, in terms of the German economy, military machine, coordination. That is such a contrast to Russia in particular, who have yet to modernise properly. And interestingly, it is this moment when those high up in the Russian government start to think about things like railways, which we'll get to later. Okay, so now in terms of the scene, we have in the Balkan context, Russian rearmament begins because of this humiliation again, and it's again a sense that it can't support its Serb ally. Serbian nationalism has intensified greatly. Cooperation between Russia and Austria-Hungary in the Balkans has ended permanently. This seems to be a permanent rift or rupture. And then we have two blocs hardening against each other. So we have these two armed camps that actually arguably are already set there with the Entente in 1907 in terms of the European context. Now we've got that sort of extra-European Balkan context, which is deeply disturbing. Two huge blocs hardened against each other with increasing tension in terms of nationalism and Serb nationalism. So how did the Balkan Wars then of 1912 to 13 raise the stakes even further?
So after the first, as we've just heard, the period between 1908 and 1912 is a period of strengthening for Russia in particular and also Serbia. And in 1912, the Russians encourage certain Balkan states, so Serbia, Greece, Montenegro, and Bulgaria, to form this Balkan League. And this Balkan League is designed to push out the Ottoman Empire from the Balkans. And that's going to start the first of these two Balkan Wars, 1912-1913. And it's going to mean that these places are successfully going to succeed in the partition of Macedonia and take possession of other former Ottoman territory.
Okay, so we've heard there about the First Balkan War and the powerful Balkan League, a stunning victory for the Serbs, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Montenegrins. They've expelled the Ottomans from, actually now, the bulk of the Balkans. This is provocative, and it's sending tremors through Europe. The great powers are scrambling, frankly, to see can they get some sort of grip, control on events. And that takes us to Sir Edward Grey and Britain. So Sir Edward Grey, the foreign minister for Britain, what does he do and what's potentially revealing there?
So absolutely. So this Balkan situation has somewhat gone out of control. Russia's basically got this group of people together, and they seem to be doing quite a lot of stuff which they weren't really supposed to be doing, and it's threatening this fine balance. And so Edward Grey brings together the London Conference in 1912 through to 1913, and the idea here is that actually the great powers are going to sweep in to the Balkans, and they're going to negotiate peace settlements between the different Balkan states and the Ottoman Empire to ensure that this conflict doesn't blow into a wider war, which is fine, except that unsettling Grey's efforts is the Balkan League itself now falls apart, because once they have had that initial success, Bulgaria is not happy with its fellow Balkan League members and who's got what at the outcome of that first Balkan War, and they then declare war against Serbia and Greece, in fact. over who gets to control Macedonia. Now, you can sort of almost see Gray pulling his hair out at this moment, because actually now the Balkan region is really becoming very, very unstable indeed. And it only gets worse because the Second Balkan War ends with Serbia's defeat of Bulgaria. And so rather than having four Balkan states with a balance of power in the Balkans, as per the London Conference had rather hoped for, we now have Serbia doubling in size, posing a direct threat to the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
So the threat, again, it's ratcheted up. And Austro-Hungary here are clearly hugely concerned. So Gray's diplomacy, the conferences between the powers, the great powers, it buys time, but it hasn't resolved those underlying, very deep ethnic and territorial tensions. So thinking about Austria-Hungary then, what's going to happen next?
So Austria-Hungary is massively threatened. So not only is Serbia twice the size, it's now got an army of 200,000 people, and it's a successful military experienced army, and with a clear ideology to expand their sort of pan-Slavic ideology. So Austria, there is no real option for Austria other than to ensure that this is crushed, because this is only going to cause the nationalities within the empire to, you know, it's going to attract them, and it may well be splitting up Austro-Hungarian from inside.
Understood. So the clock is ticking very definitely here. And the Balkans then are really important in terms of this study. They're not just a regional problem at all. They are an intersection of three empires' survival instincts. Austria-Hungary feared dissolution because of that ethnic-based sort of independence movement there. Russia are fearing humiliation, and again, this sense of sort of isolation. And then Serbia are fearing, again, sort of overlordship or being subjugated if they don't take their opportunity now. But they have taken that opportunity with both hands, as you've said, Mr. McLeod. They have now doubled in size, an army of experienced soldiers, 200,000 strong. The summer of 1914 is going to be a strong test of diplomacy. We now move on to our final consideration, which is, in the summer of 1914, how did the assassination of Franz Ferdinand lead to war? The assassination is famous, but it is worth reminding everybody listening that Europe had survived many crises before 1914 without going to war. So we need to ask, what made June through to July of 1914 different? The answer lies in a series of decisions made by individual leaders in the 6 weeks following the assassination, against the backdrop of all the structural pressures we have been discussing. Each step, the blank check, the ultimatum, then the partial mobilisation and the Schlieffen Plan, they narrowed the options until war was almost inescapable. But almost is the key word. This was not inevitable. We move on as our initial starting point to consider, who was Gavrilo Princip and what was he trying to achieve? Princip was a 19-year-old Bosnian Serb nationalist. He was a member of a small and dangerous group who were armed, and they were known as the Black Hand Gang. They were a Serbian nationalist organization dedicated to uniting all southern Slavs under Serbian rule. The head of the Black Hand, Colonel Dragutin Dimitrovic, known as Colonel Api, was a senior Serbian military officer. Whether the Serbian government sanctioned the attack remains debated. There is no definitive proof of direct government involvement. However, the assassination itself was nearly a failure. An earlier bomb attempt failed. Princip only succeeded because Franz Ferdinand's car took a wrong turn and it stalled directly in front of him. The assassination then turns our attention to the reaction, not just of Austria itself, but also of its German partner. So what was Germany's blank check and why was it so significant in this context? The 5th of July 1914 saw Kaiser Wilhelm II and his Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg
give Austria-Hungary unconditional support. We know this to be the blank check. This was a dramatic departure from Germany's previous role as a restraining force on Austrian aggression. Why did Germany do it? Historians debate it. Was this a deliberate gamble on war? This is known as the Fischer thesis. Or was it a miscalculation that the conflict would actually stay local? The effect, however, is clear. Austria-Hungary felt emboldened to act. Without this blank check, Austria-Hungary would almost certainly have hesitated or sought compromise. Moving forward, we can now consider another important question. What was the Austrian ultimatum and why was it designed to be rejected? On the 23rd of July 1914, Austria-Hungary issued a 10-point ultimatum to Serbia. The key demands were to suppress anti-Austrian propaganda, dismiss hostile officials, and allow Austrian officials to participate in the investigation into the assassination on Serbian soil. This last demand was a deliberate violation of Serbian sovereignty, designed to be unacceptable. Serbia's reply on the 25th of July accepted most demands, but rejected the intrusion of Austrian officials into the Serbian investigation. Kaiser Wilhelm's reaction was that on reading it, he wrote, "The reply amounted to a capitulation. There disappeared all reason for war." But Austria-Hungary declared war regardless. On the 28th of July 1914, Belgrade was shelled. With the aggression of Austria-Hungary and the beginning of what becomes an invasion by Austro-Hungarian forces, we now turn to Russia. How did Russia's mobilization turn a local war into a European one? Well, Russia couldn't allow Serbia to be crushed. Honor, credibility, and its Slavic protector role were all at stake after the humiliation of 1908. So on the 29th of July, Tsar Nicholas II ordered mobilization. This was intended to be against Austria-Hungary only. However, his generals told him that partial mobilization was in fact impossible. It had to be general mobilization, which included moving forces by train to the German border. What followed was the infamous exchange of telegrams known as the Willy-Nicky telegrams between Tsar Nicholas II of Russia and Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, who were cousins. They exchanged messages trying to halt the slide towards war, but neither could stop the military machine. Germany interpreted Russian general mobilization as an act of aggression and declared war on Russia on the 1st of August 1914. We now need to consider the German preparations for war. How did the Schlieffen Plan and Belgium bring Britain into the war? Germany declared war on France on the 3rd of August, claiming French planes had bombed Nuremberg. The Schlieffen Plan required Germany to invade France through Belgium, bypassing French fortifications. Belgium refused Germany's request to pass through its territory. Germany invaded, regardless, on the 3rd of August. Britain was bound by the Treaty of London of 1839 to guarantee Belgian neutrality. And then on the 4th of August, Britain issued Germany an ultimatum. They demanded the withdrawal from Belgium. However, Germany point blank refused. Britain therefore declared war, with Grey's famous words as war began, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." German Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg was astonished. He said, "For a scrap of paper, Great Britain is going to make war?" So now we can consider, was war in 1914 inevitable? or were there in fact moments when it could have been stopped? Several near-miss moments need to be considered. Serbia's conciliatory reply to the ultimatum, Kaiser Wilhelm's own comment that there disappeared all reason for war, Tsar Nicholas's attempts to limit Russian mobilization, Grey's offer that Britain would stay neutral if Germany did not attack France. Each of these offered an exit. None of them was taken. So was this a failure of individuals or of the system? So by the system we mean alliances, war plans, militarism, that gave leaders no genuine room for manoeuvre. The view of historian A.G.P. Taylor is that war plans made it mechanical. His concept is of a war by timetable. So once mobilisation began, it was in fact impossible for it to stop. The view of Keegan is that actually determined diplomatic leadership could in fact have stopped this war, and that it was an individual failure of the leaders of key states. By August 1914, every major power had taken a step it believed was defensive. None of them intended a continental war, and yet in 6 weeks they produced exactly that. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand did not cause the First World War. It simply lit the fuse on an explosive that had been carefully assembled over the previous 4 decades. That concludes our episode of In Our Welling Time, focused on the causes of the First World War. See you next time.